You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So did you thoughtfully plan out your meals ahead of the stay-at-home order? Did you make deliberate decisions on how to stock your pantry? So that may have gone by the wayside during the hunt for toilet paper and flour and other staples. We're talking about making good food choices during this crisis. And on the other side, what meals are you cooking right now? What's worked? What's something that flopped? But you had time to try and experiment with a recipe. Share what's going on in your kitchen right now. 800-642-1234. We have Sophie Egan, who is the author of the new book, How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. Sophie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I understand that you're in Seattle with your family. How are you hunkered down? What is it like there?
Well, thank you. Yes, I have been a San Francisco Bay Area resident for the past decade plus, but I'm in Seattle as my family and I are actually moving to Boulder, Colorado. So we're in a multi-generational household right now with my parents and my 14-month-old twin boys. So it's, you know, it's really all of us sharing all the information we can with each other. Now we're under mask orders. That was something we weren't doing even just 2 weeks ago, right? When going to the grocery store, we've all been using certainly gloves when we're going to the store, doing more online delivery, but the delivery is itself not a great system for lots of reasons. It's more expensive. And we're also sharing as many recipe ideas and inspiration for not getting in a cooking rut as we can. I'm fortunate that we have four different adults in the household who can bring different culinary inspiration to the dinner meal planning. That is helpful. But of course, also, you know, being mindful of all the risks that all of us are trying to be mindful of when we are doing that essential act of eating.
And certainly bumping into each other in the kitchen. I have twin boys, too. And let me tell you, I know it's a very busy time for you.
Yeah.
So when you're in the kitchen and you're thinking about your meal prep and looking at the pantry, where does your mind go? What are some things? I know you like to work with fewer ingredients more than having a ton of ingredients.
Yeah, I would say that during this what I call corona conscious eating period, a lot of the general rules that I hope readers will take away from the book in the long term apply even more so in the context of the pandemic. And I'll explain what I mean. So a general guiding principle for a healthy pantry is the same general guiding principle for a healthy diet. And that is stuff that comes from the ground, those fruits and veggies. This is not news. But in the pantry, what does that mean? The mostly plant-based foods that really are best for both ourselves, our own health, and planetary health. Things like whole grains, legumes, beans, chickpeas, lentils. Those are really having their day in the sun right
they
now.
They are. They're just like these little heroes that are everywhere.
They are, and they're rightfully heroes. They're incredibly affordable, super versatile in terms of cooking across a wide range of flavor profiles and cuisine types. They're super nutritious, form of plant protein, and they are the lowest footprint environmentally for any protein source. So these little humble guys have been kind of the unsexy dry goods are really now deservedly having their praises sung.
So those
belong in a pantry, and plant oils too, because you can't cook without some kind of cooking fat. And even looking for one of the most important things is a few dried herbs and spices goes a long way for flavor. Because if you have a lot of healthy items in your pantry, but putting them together doesn't taste good, then you won't be eating them. And then it doesn't matter how healthy they are.
Do you Instapot those beans, or do you like to just, overnight soak them?
You know, I am admittedly not a bean cooking expert. I am a bean appreciator. There's actually a great cookbook that is just going bonkers in sales right now, but deservedly so, called Cool Beans by Joe Yonian, the food editor of Washington Post. But I actually I often use canned beans. I have even pre-coronavirus, but definitely the overnight soak, if you get in the habit. I had pre-coronavirus also gotten in the habit of overnight oats. I think that's kind of an easy ritual that a lot of people can get on board with, you know, where you
so great for the morning.
Start Yeah, and then you're making the next day's tasks. You're got to jump on the next day's to-do list.
We're talking with Sophie Egan, author of the new book, How to Be a Conscious Eater. She works at the intersection of food, health, and climate. With your questions and recipe tips, have you stocked up on canned goods over the past few weeks? What items are a must-have for your recipes and in your pantry? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in a call now. Lou is joining us from northern Wisconsin this morning. Hi, Lou.
Hey, good morning. Real quick, let me get this out because she mentioned beans and buying canned. Really, to prep your own beans, it's fast, it's easy, and it's least expensive. The Vegan Instant Pot cookbook by Nisha Vora, V-O-R-A, is fantastic. She'll cover everything for you for your Instant Pot. I'm a new vegan over about a year, year and a half or so, vegetarian since 2015. And that's kind of the running meme, that's the running comment on social media right now, is that everybody wants to be vegan. They're all realizing that the food choices make a difference, because now with this rash of hoarding and stocking, we go in to get our normal staples, tofu, beans, rice, and they're gone. You know, the shelves were just vacant. So that's what my thought process has been. Are people realizing that, you know, their food, you know, let your food be your medicine. You know, are they realizing that this affects? Because if you talk to a lot of vegans, we don't get sick that much either.
Well, Lou, thank you for bringing all of these ideas to the table and helping us understand what it's like to be vegan. Sophie?
Yes. Well, I certainly agree. That in a lot of ways these are that this is a unique experience for vegans who are sort of saying, hey, we've been doing this for a long time. You know, I advocate in the book or offer the suggestion in the book that, you know, it's great for folks who can go vegetarian or vegan, but that it's not even quite necessary for the long term. So a lot of Americans in particular have a hard time maintaining a fully plant-based diet, as it's called, but it is definitely true, 100%. There's a scientific consensus that for aligning optimal nutrition with planetary boundaries, that's a wonky term for saying what can the planet handle in terms of water use, carbon emissions, mostly eating plant-based foods, that's those foods that come from the ground, as I said, is right at that bullseye of that intersection of human and environmental health. And so it's an interesting time as perhaps I think a lot of folks are having this reset, as the caller indicated too, of realizing what not only what's going to protect me in the long term. Typically, we think about nutrition as prevent disease, eat your veggies. You know, this is a down the road kind of vague concept. But now with more of the immune system, there's a more immediate feedback loop, right? Like eating this meal, oh, I feel good, I'm staying healthy, and it's you're seeing the return, if you will, on that food, as medicine and investment in a much more immediate sense.
Yeah, and certainly Lou is seeing it at the grocery store with the staples that she buys for her plant-based diet that are just not there right now. We're talking, we're talking with Sophie Egan, author of the book How to Be a Conscious Eater. We're looking at food choices, the planet, how to make thoughtful food decisions during the pandemic. Have you stocked up on canned goods over the past few weeks? Are you vegan? What items are a must-have for your pantry in your recipes? What cookbook or ingredient have you rediscovered? Are you coveting right now? Join in. Give us your tips, your insights, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Sophie Egan right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're getting a practical guide to conscious eating in the midst of the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. So plants are the healthiest food for us humans, and eating seasonal produce is good for the planet and our health. Humble beans and lentils are the heroes in these times, as we've been talking about cool beans. Have you found healthy meals that you enjoy cooking? Are you exploring new types of produce? Do you follow expiration dates and use-by dates? So what rules do you abide by with certain foods? Join in 800-642-1234. Sophie Egan's new book is called How to Be a Conscious Eater, and she's a former director at the Culinary Institute of America. She stays with us for the hour. Let's bring in Jim now in Madison with a question. Hi, Jim.
Yes, this is in relation to manufactured breakfast cereal. I have decided to read the ingredient list carefully of Cheerios and have become absolutely appalled at what they are selling.
Oh, no.
I'm looking for fiber. To get the 100 grams of fiber you're supposed to get every day, I have this friend who's been eating Cheerios for 50 years, and now he has diabetes. And if you read carefully the ingredient list, although they advertise 100% whole grains, you will find something quite different. That Cheerios, for example, has no nuts in it at all.
Well, Jim, thank you for bringing Cheerios to our table here. Sophie, I know Cheerios are a staple in our household, too, especially if you have young kids.
Yes, I hear you, Jim. This is one of the most frustrating, and yet I think in some ways can be the most empowering sort of types of moments that a conscious eater experiences in the journey. I've had these conversations with my dad in particular over the years about breakfast cereal, because by and large, it's just dessert for breakfast. There's very little nutritional value in the vast majority. Now, there's a spectrum, of course, as with all processed foods. But you're exactly right that when you actually zoom past my guidance in reading food labels, generally speaking, I have a more of a detailed guide in the book. But in general, the front of a package is a billboard. It's all the marketing material. You got to go laser focused to the two super boring black and white parts, the nutrition facts panel and the ingredients list. And in this time when a lot of folks maybe have more time on their hands or just are in creating new routines, it's great to actually take the moment to rethink some of those daily habits. Have we just been eating Cheerios every morning because it's just what we've always done? Or is it because it's really the thing that is making us, live our best lives and feel our best throughout the day? So by and large, a lot of breakfast cereals are not sufficiently whole grain. They have far too much added sugar and all kinds of other stuff. Sometimes there's BHT or food dyes or marshmallows or name your dessert item. So there are a lot of other delicious and nutritious ways to eat, to shift your breakfast habits. Oatmeal can go a long way. We talked about overnight oats just a moment ago. But in general, with those ingredient lists, and then on the whole grain piece in particular, you mentioned the misleading label. There's a lot of labels that don't mean anything, and so I suggest looking for the Whole Grains Council's little yellow stamp is a great shorthand for how much whole grain is in a product, especially breakfast cereal. And looking at that ingredients list, is the first ingredient a whole grain? Does it say whole wheat flour or oats? Those are the words you want, because the first ingredient is the most important. Ingredients are listed in descending order by weight, and that's why it's going to tell you the bulk of the product right off the bat with the first ingredient.
Are there any other things, handy tips that you would have for reading food labels? Because they are such a blur and you're trying to get in and out of stores and make your decisions really quickly. What other shorthand tips might you have?
Sure. So a couple of things. As I said, zoom past the front. So basically step one, flip it over, turn it around. That in itself will help you ignore a lot of the noise. There's so much noise on packaging, right? There are a few exceptions to that rule, by the way. There are third-party certifications. I described some of them. Fair trade, for example, organic, the Whole Grains Council stamp. Those are rigorous third party sort of auditors of versus just unverified claims. So if you are zooming past most of that information, you're already going to be at sort of at least a filter. When you're in the nutrition facts panel, there's a lot of information in there and it's pretty confusing. It's small print. The only things you really need to pay close attention to are calories do matter, but both quantity and quality matter. Added sugar, you want to keep that at bay. Fiber, as the caller mentioned, is very important, especially in the U.S., where almost no one gets about 5% of American adults and children eat the recommended amount. It's actually about 28 grams a day, by the way. The exact target depends on the person, but fiber is important. The type of fat matters far more than the amount of fat. So just looking for those healthy, unsaturated fats. You're not looking to keep total fat down. That's outdated guidance. And then definitely also, as I mentioned, trying to keep sodium at bay. With packaged foods, sodium is especially important, although sodium is even more important to be aware of when eating from restaurant food. So we can get into that later if that's of interest. Then in the ingredients list, the other thing is that there's this general notion of clean labels. And this means sort of the fewer ingredients, the better. And that has some merit. It doesn't mean that it's a black and white rule. That's a pattern or a theme of the book overall, is that there's nuance to all of this. But as a general rule, it is true that if there's ingredients you recognize, I like to think about, do you have those ingredients in your own pantry? If you don't have, hydrolated, butylated, methyl, whatever these confusing multisyllabic words are, and that can be a good indicator that it's something, that's a little bit questionable of whether or not I want that in my body if it's not something I could cook myself.
Does a clean label mean that it is preservative free?
So there are natural preservatives like citrus, like lemon juice is a preservative. You could call that a preservative, right? There's preservatives. There's not super clear. That's a great question because there's not super clear science on preservatives. Nitrates are in this category too. We're sort of, it's a little bit of a gray area. Mm-hmm. But the more important thing I have a list in the book of a really helpful shorthand from Consumer Reports called Chemical Cuisine. And this looked at sort of ingredients that are of most concern. Not Consumer Reports, the Center for Science and Public Interest. And they offer six ingredients in particular to watch out for. So those are the red dyes, blue 1, blue 2, red 40. Those have suspected ties to cancer. And then a specific preservative, BHA. So anyway, there's a couple of specific ingredients that have raised some alarm bells. But on that clean label piece, it's both sort of ones that you recognize and shorter. Those are good general guiding principles. But one thing to keep in mind is that it doesn't mean just because there's few ingredients doesn't mean it's necessarily healthy. So an example I give is nut butters. Sometimes on the front of a label, it'll say only 3 ingredients for peanut butter. Or only 4 ingredients. But in peanut butter, that's actually kind of a lot. It should just have 1 ingredient, peanuts. Like the other ingredients might be palm oil, sugar, honey. You don't need all that stuff in your peanut butter. It should just be peanuts. But then also on the flip side, salsa, for example, might have 15 ingredients and they might be really good forms of, flavoring, like parsley, onion. Maybe you want a lot for a diverse set of ingredients to really make it taste good.
Talking with Sophie Egan, who is the author of the new book, How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. Taking your questions and your recipe ideas at 800-642-1234. Sophie, let's look at expiration dates for a moment. How should we read them? How should we rely on them or not?
Yes, this is one of my greatest passions because it's a huge opportunity, actually, both from a policy standpoint and from a household education standpoint. So by and large, the dates that you see used by, best if used by, sell by, there's dozens of different ones. They're generally not regulated. The exception is infant formula. The notion we have is that they are expiration dates, as you said, but actually they're markers of food quality. They are standards that manufacturers have set for the experience they want you to have with their product from a taste, freshness standpoint. The vast majority of the time, it is perfectly safe to eat foods past the sell-by date. Now,
really?
This is where, yes. And so what's interesting is that this is a super problematic system resulting in tons and tons of food waste. In the U.S., we waste about 40% of the food that's produced. This is a crisis given that we have 40 million on the way to 70 million people who go hungry in this country. And if we just redistributed about a third of that food, we could feed all the hungry or food insecure Americans. So you have this dual crisis and a system that's very confusing. There's legislation underway actually to standardize this, one for quality, one just two labels. It would get rid of all the other ones and it would be regulated, one for quality, one for safety. We'll see if that legislation goes forward. But in the meantime, what we have to do is actually rely on our senses. So there's a great resource called SaveTheFood.com, and I pull some examples from it in the book that helps you know sort of food by food. Can, you know, so hard cheese, you can cut off the mold and eat the rest of it that wouldn't apply in soft cheese, and sort of which foods to be more mindful of those dates, whereas the other ones you might want to just use the sniff test for milk and look out for something off.
And we have a link to Save the Food at our website at WPR.org/mornings. Talking with Sophie Egan, who has a new guide on the food choices we make every day. With your insights, carrying on this conversation, 800-642-1234. Sophie Egan will be back right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Just a heads up on our programming here. I want to point you to our website where you will find live coverage of the daily White House coronavirus task force briefings. Go to WPR.org for these real-time updates. Right now, we're learning how to eat more consciously, especially at this time of a health scare. Tips like less ingredients is more. A good sharp knife goes a long way. Sophie Egan writes, every day, each one of us has the responsibility and delicious opportunity to align our food choices with our personal values. So what ingredients do you value? What recipes are wholesome and delicious? Are you planting a garden? What will be in it and why? We're at 800-642-1234. Sophie Egan's new book is called How to Be a Conscious Eater, and she stays with us. Sophie, we were talking there before the newscast about expiration dates. And so what foods can we typically eat past their expiration dates safely?
Most of them is the short answer. Common examples are eggs. And I show a little diagram in the book of a fun test for that, the sink or float test. You can put an egg in a bowl of water, and if it rises to the top, it's not safe to eat. If it sinks, it is. And this is because eggshells are semi-permeable, so it shows you how much air has gotten in there. Milk also can almost always be eaten past the date, can be consumed as a beverage past the date. And for that, you'd want to do the sniff test if it smells off. There are also things you can do with sour milk, like baking. And canned goods, you know, this is really depends. You'll have to often open the can to see, but especially in that department. And then also the flip side of that, though, is that there are some foods that you may notice, like deli prepared foods, sandwiches that you get that have a date where in sometimes they actually start to grow mold before the date, and that can be frustrating. So just this is to that point again, that in the absence of that legislation, you have to just keep an eye out, use your sense of smell to sniff for something off. And then there are a lot of other tricks you can do for, or hacks, as people like to say, for extending the life of food. So your freezer, going back to the pantry question too, I tend to think of my freezer as an extension of my pantry. That's where I really am a fan of frozen vegetables and frozen produce or frozen berries and fruit. One of my biggest pet peeves again is when you splurge maybe on some fresh berries and they, you know, sprout the fuzz just a day after you get them home. It's also very economical. So freezer is a great way just in general for foods that are frozen to begin with, but also to extend the life. One of the tricks from, we were talking about SaveTheFood.com before, One of the tricks they suggest is, coffee. If you're buying in bulk, perhaps again for economic reasons or because you're trying to go to the store less often, you can put the coffee in your freezer and dole out weekly bags on the countertop for the fresh taste. And that's going to get you along. That's going to help it last a lot longer.
Okay, so here in Wisconsin, we love cheese. Let's just establish that. What about when you do see that mold growing on the cheese? Can you just cut off that part? What would you suggest?
Yes. So this is interesting. You can for harder cheeses, and then you can eat the rest of the product. For cheeses that are soft, shredded, crumbled, or sliced, mold can spread throughout those cheeses. Mm. I'm sure there are many listeners who are far more expert than I in the cheese making. However, my understanding is it has to do with the structure, the crystallized structure of hard cheeses versus soft cheeses. So that's a general rule is the hard versus soft. And then for bread, it's the same concern. Bread you can typically cut off the piece and eat the rest as well.
So Sophie, when you're preparing your berries for the freezer, what do you do?
Sorry, good point of clarification. I was just saying that I actually am a fan of frozen berries, of frozen fruits and vegetables in general. But there are a lot of things you can do to, I learned recently about freezing bananas, for example, because that, and there are other ways to slow the ripening of bananas. As a side note, one of the things I learned is that if you keep that little plastic wrap on the stem of a banana, you may see that in the grocery store, that actually can slow down the ripening. It's the stem is really where all the is where it all begins. Yes, yeah. From a ripening standpoint, which makes sense, right? Because that's where it's pulled off the tree. Then you can freeze bananas. I made the mistake of freezing them myself, just whole in there in the freezer, but it suggested actually that you peel it first.
Oh, so yeah. And then you can again, have the frozen bananas with the chocolate on top, which is what I love.
I know.
They're so good.
And kids love them too.
I know. Great. Yeah. Let's take another call now. Victor is with us from West Dallas. Hi, Victor.
Hi, good morning. Hey, a few things for you. On your breakfast, like my wife makes for me, old fashioned oatmeal, the frozen organic blueberries with raisins, and then because we're getting old, she chops up her almonds and sprinkle them on top. That's for her breakfast, okay? Two, on the milk situation, if you look at the organic milk in the old plastic cartons, you find out you can get 2 weeks longer versus the gallon jugs that you see in the store.
Huh. So the organic milk can be extended longer. Is there anything to that, Sophie?
No, that's really interesting. I had not heard that. I mean, in the other thing that probably you would notice is that it depends on who the milk producer is. But I would be curious if that organic milk happened to be a local producer, because certainly if it had to travel less of a distance to get to you in the first place, you probably get longer time to enjoy it. So I would certainly think that local producers are going to give you much longer, but the organic versus conventional, I had not heard that before.
We're talking with Sophie Egan. She's a food systems consultant. She's out with a new book. It's called How to Be a Conscious Eater. And you can join in. Are you trying to reduce your waste right now? Are you spending more time thinking about your recipes, thinking about what is in your pantry and your refrigerator, how you will use that produce? Join in with your tips, your recipe ideas, and how you're getting by right now in the kitchen. We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sophie, let's talk more about cooking oil and how you think about using cooking oil as you put together your dishes.
Certainly. So there's I wrote a piece for the New York Times a while back that was sort of the coconut oil versus olive oil smackdown, because coconut oil has gotten a lot of attention as a superfood, and especially you know, it's seen as sort of the magic to all, cures all your problems, for skincare to health. And really, when you dig into the science, there's not a lot to that claim. Generally, what I suggest keeping in mind with cooking oils is the fat profile. So I mentioned before with Nutrition Facts panel that the scientific consensus is that the type of fat is much more important from a health consideration than the total amount of fat. We actually want to eat healthy fats. So those are unsaturated, monounsaturated, or polyunsaturated. Those don't need to get too bogged down in all of that, but basically those are plant oils, olive oil, canola oil, nut oils, peanut oil, for example, tend to be rich in those. And generally, fat sources that come from animal-based foods, lard and butter in particular, tend to have far more of the unhealthy fats, saturated fats. So what I look for is the fat profile. And it's most important when we're talking about what is your kind of workhorse daily cooking oil.
Yeah,
it doesn't
yeah.
mean never use the other oils, but or other types of cooking fat, but what's your go-to? So olive oil and canola oil are great go-tos as your general workhorse oils, but it really also depends on the smoke point. So I have a little diagram in the book that kind of breaks those down. Some are more suited for high temperature cooking, grilling, and the like. Others are better for, you know, drizzling or more of a salad dressing, for example. So keeping those things in mind are important. And then some people, you know, do want to know, what about extra virgin? What about,
darker versus lighter? And, you know,
yes,
what is light?
There's so
anyway.
Many kinds.
Yeah.
Right. So other than that, you know, one of the things to keep in mind is that refined oils, that's sort of what's called like regular olive oil. Those are generally have a higher smoke point. But there are some concerns of a solvent that's used called hexane in the extraction process. So kind of extracting the oil from the fruit, whatever it is. And that has some concerns, especially at high levels for workers. But it's kind of a conundrum because they're also tend to be more affordable. So extra virgin olive oil is a good way to go because you're it has very strict quality and nutrition content standards, and no hexane is involved. And then expeller pressed, you also might see that. That also means no hexane. And cold pressed, it means it's sort of a more traditional approach.
It gets
organic oils
really complicated
also,
really fast.
It does.
And then you do see organic out there as well. What are the distinctions there?
Yes, I completely agree. It's very complicated. And this is where the sort of upfront investment in what become your go-to products can really pay off, because then you don't have the decision fatigue of going through this process for every item in your kitchen. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of reap the benefits down the road of having learned all of this. But definitely organic versions have become more ubiquitous, thankfully, at least of olive oil and canola oil. But basically they have the same sort of standards in terms of no chemicals or heat used to extract the oil. So don't get too bogged down in that. The main point is oils that come from plant-based foods are going to get you a long way. And anything at room temperature, which includes coconut oil as well as lard and butter, generally best for more special occasion uses.
Sophie Egan with us. She consults with the restaurant and food service industries on building healthier menus, and she's out with a new guidebook on healthy eating with your tips along the way at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and our guide is Sophie Egan this hour. She writes in her new guidebook on conscious eating that you don't have to apologize for not going full-on vegan or vegetarian. She says, as long as you're eating a variety of healthy foods and not too much from animals, you can still be a conscious eater. So what are the foods you're savoring right now during this pandemic? Have you baked whole grain bread from scratch? Are you incorporating more nuts and seeds and leafy greens? Is this a turning point in your kitchen? Tell us about it. Still time, 800-642-1234. Sophie Egan's new book is called How to Be a Conscious Eater, and she stays with us. Sophie, let's turn to restaurants right now, which are closed straight across the country, but many restaurants are still trying to get us to get their takeout. How should we approach restaurants right now and the food and the takeout?
Yes, this is something I'm thinking a lot about, given that this is the industry I've been part of and continue to be part of, restaurants and food service. It's, you know, an enormous part of our economy, and these are our neighbors, these small business owners and restaurant workers. So there's definitely a lot we can do. And I'm sure many of us enjoy having a break from the cooking as well, if you do have delivery available in your area. So a couple of general suggestions when ordering right now in particular. One is, as much as possible, those smaller businesses are really vulnerable. They live they're operating very on small margins. Paycheck to paycheck is a concept on an individual level, but this is really the case in many of these businesses' potential to exist past the crisis. So opting for your local smaller businesses can be a really good default when deciding which piece of place to order from, for example. Also, for your own health, you know, right now we need to be super mindful of our immune systems. And so loading up, we talked about foods that come from the ground. But that, you know, eating from takeout doesn't have to be the break the bank, over the top, indulgent experience. And actually, there's a lot of delicious vegetable options. So I would suggest to load up on veggies first and foremost in your cart or in your order. Also, we've mentioned food waste. This is incredibly important from a climate standpoint. So estimates are that if food waste were a country, it'd be the third largest emitter after China and the United States. Mm. Most of that happens in the household level for us in the U.S., but a lot of it happens also just if we order more food than we need at a restaurant. And the same applies, we have to remember, that same applies when ordering food for takeout. So just ensuring that you're doing everything you can to minimize waste. Some examples are, often foods come, if you think about, you know, a Chinese takeout order, often it comes with a lot of rice. If you know you're not going to eat the rice, opt out of it at the point of ordering. You can opt out of things like, you know, bread that you're not going to eat. No, not saying you need to not eat the bread, but if you know you're not going to eat it anyways, if it's the extra potatoes on the side or whatever it is, minimizing waste at the point of purchase, and also minimizing the plastic waste. A lot of takeout orders come with the little to-go, you know, cutlery. You're eating this at home, so you probably don't need that. You could see if you can
Or those little packets of soy sauce or things like that.
Exactly. Right. So looking for ways in the notes part of the delivery app to minimize waste. And then another really important thing to look for is doing your homework on the practices of those restaurants ahead of time. How are they paying their workers? Do they have sustainable practices as much as possible? There's a lot of information now available, scorecards. Consumer Reports does one. This is for chain restaurants that looks at whether or not restaurateurs are purchasing meats that are raised with antibiotics, and they have can point you to better supply, better restaurateurs. There's also a scorecard from the Restaurant Opportunity Center called the Diner Guide. There's an app, and it shows you high road restaurants that really give good benefits to their workers, sick pay. They pay them fair wages. And then the third thing to think about with that environmental piece is there's a growing movement now around carbon neutral restaurants. This gets me super excited because it's not out there just yet. But in the future, you could actually search on Yelp or in your Open Table or in your delivery app by restaurants that are carbon neutral. So there's a fantastic effort called Zero Foodprint, led by a husband-wife team, Chef Anthony Mient and Karen Leibowitz. And zerofoodprint.org has the list of all the restaurants that are carbon neutral so far. But coming soon, hopefully that designation will really enable you to choose to use your takeout dollars in support of restaurants that are doing their part for climate action.
Super helpful information. Thank you for joining us, Sophie.
Thank you so much for having me. Be well.
You too. Sophie Egan, founder of Full Table Solutions, which is a consulting firm for food systems. Her new book is called How to Be a Conscious Eater. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum remembering a Wisconsin artist who recently passed away.
Dr. Evermore turned bits of metal and other salvage parts into fantastic sculptures beginning in 1983. People can find his truly one-of-a-kind works of art behind Delaney's Surplus near Baraboo. There, he created a whole world of mechanical creatures, insects, birds, and other contraptions. Dr. Evermore, or Tom Every, passed away last week at age 81. To remember this Wisconsin artistic giant, we're going to revisit this story from a few years ago when reporter Gilman Halstead went to talk with the artist about his sculptures.
I am Tom Every from Brooklyn, Wisconsin, the junk dealer. And now I am Dr. Evermore, the crazy guy, okay?
Evermore spent years running a salvage and demolition company. He saved industrial machinery parts from the more than 300 factories, breweries, power plants, and rail cars he dismantled and collected others. He became convinced these obsolete pieces of metal had become imbued with the spirit of their original creators and decided to make them into pieces of art that embodied that spirit.
We're working with pre-existing shapes and forms that lose their original identity, become something else, without altering any of them. So that is one of the Ten Commandments, okay? So when we look at something, it's plenty good the way it is, now how can we use it?
Dr. Evermore has created a myth about himself and his art. It begins with his first and most ambitious work, the Forevertron.
I am a slight rebel, and I don't particularly like certain entities, which I don't really care to name, such as the establishment. I thought that I could get back into the heavens. That's where this thing came from. This is designed to perpetuate yourself back into the heavens in a glass ball, in a copper egg, on a magnetic lightning force beam. It is a could-be fantasy, and that's what it is, but it is built of the real material.
The real material the Forevertron is made of includes a 6,000-pound transformer from an old powerhouse dam in Prairie du Sac, a huge compressor from a Sheboygan power plant, and what the doctor calls a decontamination chamber. It was actually used by Apollo astronauts. The entire spaceship weighs more than 300 tons. Built in the 1980s with the help of a few friends, it's the centerpiece of the Evermore Sculpture Park, nestled in a grove of cottonwood trees on Highway 12 in Sauk County, across the road from the old Badger Army ammunition plant. In a nearby meadow are a bizarre assortment of huge metal birds with long ostrich-like necks and elaborate crowns of metal feathers. Some of the birds have musical instruments welded into their bodies. Guitars, French horns, saxophones, trumpets. The feathers on these birds are flattened pieces of metal that can be played like chimes. They stand watching the Forevertron, ready to strike up the band when it's time for its celestial voyage. But before he takes off in the Forevertron, Dr. Evermore would like to pass on some of his skills to young artists with their own visions. He'd like to see the park become a studio for welders like him who enjoy giving new life to old metal.
All I can leave anybody is something, not any big bank accounts or anything else, and say unto you or anybody else, you can do it. Power on.
That story on Tom Every, also known as Dr. Evermore, came to us from Gilman Halstead, a former reporter with Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Evermore passed away last week at the age of 81. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.